Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Scheduled news conference this morning, President Bush insisted that Iraq has not fallen into civil war, that failure there is not an option, that there will be no White House staff shakeup or resignation from Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. For nearly an hour, the president, often joking with reporters, took a wide range of questions, but he bristled at the suggestion from longtime White House correspondent Helen Thomas that he, the president, wanted to wage war against Iraq from the early days of his presidency.
You know, I didn't want war. To assume I wanted war is just flat wrong, Helen, in all due respect. No, hold on for a second, please. Excuse me. No president wants war. Everything you may have heard is that, but it's just simply not true.
Boston Globe reporter Rick Klein joins us on the line from Washington. Rick, you heard the exchange. I'm sure that jumped out at you today.
It did. Well, the first thing that jumped out at me is that the president called on Helen Thomas at all. He's avoided her at most of the press conferences he's had over the last few years because she's grown increasingly critical of the war and her questioning of White House spokesman Scott McClellan and others. But my sense is that the president probably called on her today knowing the kind of question that he'd get, a pretty hostile question about the conduct of the war, and he wants to put a lot of those questions to doubt, a lot of those concerns about the run-up to war to sleep. And I think his answer was designed to assuage some of the fears again about the run-up to the war.
Is that, do you think, why we're hearing President Bush speaking so much?
Yes, I think that's entirely why. I think they realize that passing a big anniversary date of the Iraq invasion, the third anniversary, and there's a sense of angst around the country about the direction of the war, and they're at an increasingly violent period. Some people are calling it close to a civil war. The president very firmly suggested that that's not the case. His opinion is that it's not the case, that they're in a civil war. So, yeah, I think the White House realizes and the president realizes that there's a lot of doubts about the conduct of the war, the idea of whether the war was a good thing to do in the first place. He's now given a couple of major addresses, and I think the news conference is another opportunity to speak directly to people on that.
Well, yesterday the president was asked by a civilian in Cleveland if the president thought he still had a mandate. You know, why should we trust you? Also, he was asked today the same thing, and he was asked by a reporter what he, the president, would tell a Republican voter in Cleveland that this reporter met, who said that the president is losing her vote. What did President Bush say in response to that?
Well, what he said essentially is, you know, I'm continuing to do what's right for the American people. And the interesting thing today, I don't think it was a response to that question, but he fell back on 9/11, which is something he's often referred to when talking about Iraq, even though there's no connection between the 9/11 hijackers and Saddam Hussein, is that his whole worldview changed after 9/11, and the idea of a preemptive war has come first and foremost to his mind. I think it is something that concerns him. Obviously, he's never going to be up for election again, but his poll numbers have a drag on Republican members of Congress, make it harder for his agenda to get through, and he has to be concerned about that voter in Cleveland as well as millions more across the country who have more doubts about the president's leadership.
Was he asked about troop withdrawal, and what did he say?
Well, what he's said repeatedly about troop withdrawal is that he's not going to set any kind of a time frame on that. Although he's also said that he does anticipate significant withdrawals through 2006. But I think an interesting question was when he was asked about how long it's plausible that there will continue to be American troops in Iraq, and he did not directly answer it, but he made reference to a future American president and a future Iraqi president. So that's, you know, clearly signaling that he's talking about something beyond 2008, early 2009, when he's out of the presidency. So I think that's, you know, that was more of a frank recognition of the time frame than we've heard from the administration in a while to acknowledge that this is a very long-term commitment, at least three more years.
Well, the president was also asked about immigration reform. He supports a guest worker program and increased border enforcement. He mentioned what he called an interesting debate, what to do about immigrants who have families here. We only have a few seconds left, but I'm imagining many Republicans don't see that as interesting. They find that very divisive.
They do very much. He is not with the conservative members of his party on this particular issue. He's more with the business interests and a lot of the moderate members of the party in wanting to set up a guest worker program, do something about the undocumented immigrants who are currently here, although they won't call it amnesty, some kind of a path toward legalization. This is an extremely, extremely contentious debate. It's something that Congress is going to pick up actually next week when they return from their week-long break. And it's really not clear at this point whether any consensus is going to emerge or whether any legislation is ever going to reach the president's desk. But this is a tough, tough issue for him within his own Republican Party.
Rick Klein covers Washington for the Boston Globe. He listened in on President Bush's hastily set up press conference today. Rick, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Fishermen will gather in Oregon later this week to protest an unprecedented move by the Bush administration to curtail ocean fishing in southern Oregon and the northern California coast to try to restore depleted salmon stocks. The fishermen say they're being unfairly blamed for a failure to address real causes of salmon decline, dams, water warming, and water and habitat degradation. Filmmaker Julia Whitty would agree to a point. She says the world's oceans and its inhabitants are at a tipping point that could have drastic consequences. She details a laundry list of threats in a recent article in Mother Jones magazine. They include global warming, pollution. But she doesn't let the fishing industry or fishermen off the hook. Julia Whitty makes underwater documentary films. She joins us from her home in California. And Julia, let's first talk about some of the fishing techniques you say are destroying fish stocks. Tell us first about trawling, you know, these 100-mile nets that you say are like bulldozers on the floor of the ocean.
Let's say we did eat lions or a high-end terrestrial predator, and we went out onto the savannas of Africa, and we threw a net around the entire savanna. We dragged in everything, all the wildebeest, all the gazelles, all the antelopes. We ruined all of the plant life that was growing as we dragged in this net in order to eat a few lions. That's what we're doing in the oceans.
That's trawling with nets. You also write about long lines.
They can be over 100 miles long, and they're set with up to perhaps as many as 11,000 hooks per set. And sadly, the fishing is very indiscriminate. So the total world catch, about 25% of it perhaps, is actually fish that nobody wants, and there is no market for them. And this is called bycatch. These animals are thrown overboard, either dead or dying. And this amounts to perhaps as much as 88 billion pounds of life a year. The seas are not inexhaustible, as we may have believed when we were younger. And we're actually beginning to see the effects of this indiscriminate fishing. The world fish catch leveled off around the year 2000, and perhaps as much as 10 or 12 years earlier than that, despite more effort, better technology, and more hours spent at sea. In other words, no matter how hard we try, we can no longer bring in the amount of fish we used to bring in. The fisheries of the oceans are in serious decline.
Well, let's continue with some of these fishing mechanisms. The drift nets, you describe them as these sort of ghostly 100-mile-long death traps.
Yeah, well, drift nets are gigantic nets that are set below the ocean surface. And in theory, fishers come back and they collect their nets and they take out of them what they want. But in fact, working in turbulent seas and in stormy weather, drift nets get lost. And these are then called ghost nets. And ghost nets can continue to fish way down deep, drifting on their own subsurface currents. And they can fish with nightmarish efficiency for years, if not decades.
Paint that picture a little more, because, again, you describe these ghostly monofilament 150-mile-long nets catching, trapping, and killing fish, which decay and then attract more predators.
As the nets fill up with dying fish that decay, more predators are drawn in. They're caught in these nets. They're effectively a kind of a gill net, and they can't see them in the dark water. They're caught. They die. They decay, bringing in more predators. And this kind of fishing goes on for years with ghost nets, and the ocean is riddled with ghost nets now.
Well, one marine ecologist told you that a paradigm shift is needed in fisheries management.
For the most part, fisheries managers on planet Earth are still doing single-species management. And it doesn't work because we watch one after another of these managed fisheries are still collapsing. Fisheries biologists have developed a new form of dealing with fisheries, and they're working with what they call ecosystem management. We do this on the land. You don't just manage a caribou herd. You actually manage the whole ecosystem that the caribou lives within. We haven't quite evolved to the point where we're ready to put this into action in the ocean, and as a result, the oceans are suffering. But we know what to do if we could simply translate what we know from the land into the ocean and begin ecosystem-based management. We could have a much better effect on the fisheries in the ocean.
Well, let's move to pollution because there's so much to move through here. We know there are concerns about ocean pollution, but who knew that Sweden calculates that its population of 8.9 million people carries 2.8 tons of mercury fillings in their mouths, and that mercury ends up in the ocean?
As more and more humans on Earth are cremated upon death, the crematory emissions actually are releasing mercury into the atmosphere, which is then rained down into bodies of water, predominantly the ocean. The other major sources of mercury pollution are coal and chlorine burning industries that release tons of mercury into the ocean every year. This mercury bioaccumulates. It ends up in the little teeny critters, which get eaten by bigger fish and bigger fish and bigger fish, and it accumulates in the top-level predators, the tunas, the swordfish, the marine mammals like whales and dolphins in extremely high levels, so that a lot of these animals are actually beginning to suffer and decline. There's evidence to some extent that reproduction has been affected in some of these species among marine mammals. We're also seeing in human beings, study after study is showing that people are starting to suffer, and there is very high levels of mercury poisoning in certain populations of people. In the United States, there are warnings out to pregnant women, lactating women, and children to reduce the amount of these fish that they eat. And in Europe, these restrictions are even more strict than they are here in the U.S., where the tuna lobby has been pretty effective at keeping tuna off those lists.
There's also sound pollution. Sonar?
The military and the oil drilling industries are now currently producing the loudest sounds ever produced on planet Earth, and they're planning to deploy them, the Navy is, across something like 80% of the world ocean. Now, we already know that the deployment of this sonar, which the Navy uses to look for submarines, kills at least marine mammals. We know that it causes mass strandings and deaths of whales, dolphins, manatees, and other marine mammals, and we don't know what the effect is on the greater marine ecosystem and all the life within it, which in the water, sound is the equivalent of sight on the land. So we're basically blinding much of the life of the seas by putting in these very, very powerful noises.
Julia Whitty, for 30 years she's been making underwater documentary films, and she's detailed the problems she's seen in the ocean for Mother Jones magazine. The problems you just talked about, Julia, and also others that ultimately lead to dead zones. This is when oceanic oxygen is depleted to a level lower than is needed to maintain life. Tell us more about dead zones. What do they look like?
A dead zone is basically empty of pretty much all marine life. A few jellyfish can survive in it, but other than that, it is bereft of life. And they are, sadly, a byproduct of the Green Revolution. As we created chemical fertilizers to make plants bloom on the land, these fertilizers ran off through streams and tributaries and were eventually delivered into the ocean, where, lo and behold, they made plants bloom in the ocean. And as you have too many plants blooming in the ocean, as they die and fall to the bottom, the decomposing organisms begin to thrive, and they eat those dead plants, but they also use up all the available oxygen in the water. Now, those marine animals that can run or can run fast enough will leave the area, but many things simply die.
Julia Whitty talking about a condition called hypoxia. Scientists say one of the biggest dead zones is in the Gulf of Mexico. It's the size of New Jersey. When we come back, more with Julia. She did her own diving and also worked with researchers from the Oceanic Institute here at Woods Hole in Massachusetts. We'll talk about the other problems facing the ocean, including what happens to those plastics that you throw out. You'll never throw one out again. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Journalist Julia Whitty. She writes about the threats facing the world's oceans in the March-April edition of Mother Jones magazine. And Julia, your critics say this is a world that regenerates, that oceans can adjust to changes in the atmosphere. They have in the past, they will in the future. You say we're closer to a tipping point. What do you think has to happen to pull back from that tipping point?
Well, obviously, our biggest effort is the burning of fossil fuels. We have the technology to change that, to mitigate those problems. Our current administration in Washington, D.C. has done nothing. It has set us backwards. We have actually lost ground. 2005 had the highest CO2 emissions yet on planet Earth. Now, we've been talking about this problem for 20 years. Why aren't we at least seeing CO2 emissions coming down instead of still going up? This does not bode well.
Again, the CO2 emissions are what help create these hypoxic conditions that you write about.
They're part of the problem. They're also what lead to the overall global warming of the ocean.
Well, and just give us the headline on global warming.
All of our oceans are connected, and they run on something that oceanographers call the ocean conveyor belt, so that a drop of rain that falls into the North Atlantic emerges 1,200 years later in the North Pacific. All of the oceans of the world are connected, and they run on a series of surface and subsurface currents. We know from looking at the past that at times when the climate has changed, rainfall has changed, ice melt has changed, that the ocean conveyor belt has sometimes completely stopped running, or it has run in a different direction. When that happens, global climate change takes off with vehement force, and that's what we're possibly looking at. December of this past year, British oceanographers found the first evidence that this ocean conveyor belt, a very critical part of it in the North Atlantic, is in fact slowing down.
You spent a lot of time on a research boat that was out of Woods Hole here on Cape Cod in Massachusetts, and you also are a diver, and you're writing a book about coral reefs. Older than prairies of flowering plants, you say, and have survived a lot. But what are you seeing now? What do you see when you go in the water that alarms you?
Basically, I mean, I've been diving for 25 years, and the changes I've seen in that very brief window are alarming enough that I've really been forced to try and talk about these issues any which way I can. You know, reefs that I dove that were once pristine are now little more than fields of lettuce underwater. Time after time, place after place, things that were small problems in local areas have gone pandemic and are all over the world now.
We'll stay with the reefs for a second. You say the increasing acidity of the ocean as a result of these carbon dioxide levels does what to the reefs?
Basically, as we increase carbon dioxide and acidity within the ocean, we're impacting the ability of tiny little marine animals and marine plants to make shells and bones. And experiments done by some Australian researchers took water that they estimate will have the acidity that the oceans will have by the year 2100. They popped little animals in it, and within 48 hours, their shells and bones had dissolved. And this is what we're coming up upon, possibly faster. Most of these changes now are beginning to accelerate. They're startling scientists with how quickly they're happening just within the past couple of years.
You know, one of the other threats to the ocean that we didn't mention, but it's such a simple thing that could have such huge ramifications. You write about how plastic pollutants are now floating around in the ocean. We all see them, you know, styrofoam containers, the things you throw out at the beach, or plastic bottles. How are they impacting ocean life?
A lot of larval and tiny baby forms of animals travel around the ocean on driftwood and pieces of pumice from volcanic eruptions that float. And we've known that these little boats are mechanisms by which animals travel around and seed the broader ocean. But suddenly we've introduced just billions of new boats in the forms of buoyant plastics that are floating everywhere in the ocean. And we're finding now a scientist with the British Antarctic Survey have found that biodiversity is beginning to be affected as more and more animals are able to travel much greater distances on way more boats, and they're actually colonizing heretofore impossible places for them to reach. And this, of course, it's the equivalent of introducing exotic species into your environment, and they have the effect of wiping out a lot of the native species.
And further, as you write, some of these little fish are eating some pellets, those packing peanuts and stuff. You say they're known as nurdles?
In some cases, these nurdles are being incorporated into the tissues of marine animals. And larger plastic things like plastic shopping bags and things which end up in the ocean, plastic balloons, which just people let off into the air all the time without thinking about it, those are actually ingested by things like sea turtles, which are very, very endangered. And often the presence of a plastic bag or a balloon in their stomach will kill them.
Mm. It's a really alarming picture that you paint. I was thinking the only good news that I saw here was that sharks have become endangered. You have a wonderful way of illustrating that, by the way. You are someone who's made documentary films, and you say that it used to be that when a cameraman was down, all he had to do was move and there'd be a million sharks. But now...
Sharks are hard to find. The big pelagic predatory sharks, the oceanic white tips and makos and blue sharks that used to be really prevalent, you basically can't find them anymore. If you wanted to, you can go out and chum for days and you might bring in a baby or two, but they just don't exist. Oceanic white tip sharks, once considered the most numerous shark in the Gulf of Mexico, is now estimated at 99% gone.
And you say the cameramen are now going to all these contortions to try to, you know, using wide-angle lenses to make sharks look bigger if they have to do underwater photography. You know, some people who don't like sharks would say, well, that's the good news, but in fact, it's the bad news.
Biodiversity depends on both predation and competition. And the more you take predators and competitors out of an ecosystem, the more everything suffers. So we all need these big, scary things in the ocean for the oceans to be healthy.
And are you hopeful that this is going to be reversed?
I don't see yet anything that gives me hope other than the reality that we know what to do. So it's a matter of, can we stop this march of folly, which is what we are really on, and tackle the true threats to homeland security that lie in front of us?
Documentary filmmaker Julia Whitty, she researched and wrote an extensive article on oceans for the March-April edition of Mother Jones Magazine. Her upcoming book is There Are Many Souls Embodied in the Water, Tales from the Coral World. Stay with us. More ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the
in Illinois, a state where Democrats are hoping come November to pick up a congressional seat that's been held by Republican Henry Hyde, who's retiring after 32 years in office. In this year's midterm elections, Democrats need 15 seats to shift the balance of power in the House of Representatives, and Vice President Dick Cheney in Illinois today is calling Hyde's soon-to-be vacant seat a Republican must-have. New York Times reporter Jody Rudoran has been following the race for Hyde's seat. And Jody, tell us more. What's so important about this race in Illinois?
There are a couple of things, Robin. I mean, first of all, with the race so tight for taking control of the House, every seat that could possibly be in play is just critical and is going to have a lot of money attached to it. But there are two other elements that make this seat particularly interesting. This is a seat that's in mostly in DuPage County, west of Chicago. It's a place that has been Republican for a very long time. But in recent national elections, you've seen a shift, and the Republican margins have become smaller as we see more and more people move from the city to the suburbs, and more diverse constituencies, Hispanics, Asians, moving into suburbs like DuPage County. This is happening all over the country, and the Democrats are anxious to prove that they can win suburban districts, not just to take control of the House, but for the national election in 2008. They need to break out of this pattern of only holding on to the heavily minority, heavily urban areas, because, you know, as you look at the red-blue map after each presidential election, you see the diminishing geography that Democrats control. The second major thing is that one of the candidates in the Democratic primary is Tammy Duckworth. She's a helicopter pilot, an Army major, who was shot down over Iraq with a grenade and lost both of her legs. She's one of several dozen military veterans running as Democrats this year, and the Democrats are hoping that having these military veterans on their ballots will help blunt the traditional Republican advantages in security. So they've got a candidate that they really like in a district that they would very much like to win.
Well, L. Tammy Duckworth, as you say, one of the Democratic congressional candidates in today's primary, is a Vietnam vet, a double amputee. We want to mention the other candidates as well, her two main opponents. But this is, we understand, quite an experience for voters to meet her.
Absolutely. I mean, she is really got a very compelling story. She's 37 years old. She's half Thai. Her parents, her father was an American diplomat. Her mother was an ethnic Chinese woman living in Thailand. And she lost both of her legs in this helicopter accident in Iraq. She's one of very few women helicopter pilots in combat. And she's also the natural campaigner. She's very open about her injuries, about her story, and very eager to sort of transform that experience into a political career based on health care.
But let me ask you something. What does she say about the war?
You know, it's interesting. She, first of all, has this, you know, she's very strong on supporting the troops, and she talks about her own experiences there. She says that she thinks that we need to get out of Iraq, but she's unwilling to set a timetable because she thinks that, you know, that gives too much information to the enemies. But she wants to set what she calls benchmarks for every Iraqi battalion that's trained to withdraw an American one. She also talks mainly about, she says she thinks that Congress needs more people like her who really know what's going on over there. She gave me one example of, you know, eating in the mess hall where a subsidiary of Halliburton is paid $22 per soldier per meal. You know, she says, you know, she has that firsthand experience. She says she knows how to evaluate how the war is going, how the military training camps are going.
She's also been quoted as saying, as a double amputee, she knows a lot about health care.
That's right.
But her her competitors, a software engineer, Christine Segelis, and Wheaton College professor Lindy Scott, and Segelis in particular, have said, well, she's an interloper. She's an outsider. What do they mean?
Well, Tammy, first of all, does not live actually in the district. She lives a few miles outside of the district, which is allowed by the Constitution, but obviously is not perceived all that well often by voters. But more than that, what Christine Segelis' argument is that this is someone who was recruited by the National Democratic Party, by Rahm Emanuel, the congressman from Chicago, by Dick Durbin, the senator from Illinois, and is supported by Hillary Clinton and John Kerry, and most of her money, most of her financial contributions, which there have been a lot, are coming from New York and California and Chicago and not this homegrown, you know, district support. So Christine, who ran against Henry Hyde last time in 2004 and got 44% of the vote and basically has continued to run steadily for 2.5 years, she says that she is of the district, she knows the district, and that she can better represent the district than a celebrity with a compelling story.
And I'm wondering if this sets up an interesting problem for the Democrats in that they so badly need to win these seats. She's a veteran and a trooper for the party, and yet they have a new star moving in. So is she feeling abandoned by the party?
She does. She actually basically never felt very supported by the party. When she ran in 2004, it was, you know, a ridiculous long shot running against this, you know, entrenched incumbent Republican leader, and she didn't really get any help from the party then.
Well, and as we head into primary day, all three of the Democrats are hoping in the fall to take on State Senator Peter Roskam, who's a Wheaton attorney who is running for the Republican Party to replace Henry Hyde, who, as we said, is retiring after 32 years in office.
And Mr. Roskam is a conservative Republican who has support from Mr. Hyde. He has Vice President Dick Cheney came out to do a fundraiser for him. So he has very strong support from the administration and his party leadership.
The vice president has said this is a must-win race.
That's right.
What are the odds?
Well, it's hard to know for sure. I mean, the best sort of way we can look at it is that in 2004, George W. Bush got 53% of the vote in that district, and Senator Barack Obama, who's a Democrat and who was running against a pretty weak Republican, carried the district in the mid-60s. So it's a district that, you know, seems like it could be changing. And, you know, particularly if Tammy Duckworth wins the primary, it seems like, you know, this is going to just attract more and more attention. When I spent the day with her last week, I met Republicans who, you know, were very interested in her candidacy.
And again, back to Tammy Duckworth, the Iraq veteran, the double amputee who's running in the Democratic primary today. Who is she going to appeal to? Will she appeal to, you know, stop the war lefties, or will she appeal to ardent supporters of the troops on the right?
It's a very good question. I think she's trying to split the difference somewhat. She's unwilling to. She says she thinks the war was a mistake, basically, but she won't say we need to get out right now, which, you know, is what Christine Segelis is saying, you know, that 12-month timetable. So I think, you know, she's interesting because I think she may not appeal to the left-wing anti-war people, but who else are they going to have to vote for, you know, if she's a nominee, and yet she may pick up some support from a traditional conservative base of military veterans, support the troops kinds of people. So we'll see.
New York Times reporter Jody Rodoran on the primary day taking place in Illinois today, a closely watched primary as Democrats try to get a seat held by longtime Republican Henry Hyde. Jody, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
I want to quickly correct something I just said. Of course, people on both sides of the war issue believe that they are supporting the troops. And as local politicians battle it out to get to Washington, one wonders how often they'll be there. Here's a quick note about Congress from USA Today. The paper reviewed the House of Representatives schedule for this year and came up with some interesting facts. During the first 2 months of 2006, the House was in session for a total of 47 hours. Members took almost the entire month of January off. If the House sticks to its current schedule, it will be in session for 97 days for the entire year. That's 11 days less than the Congress that Harry Truman labeled the do-nothing Congress back in 1948. The paper also points out that both chambers schedule little work for Mondays and Fridays. Members of Congress say they're meeting with constituents.
It's 3 a.m.
She comes at dawn like a big black B-52 bomber with hair.
You're sitting on my head. And it's 3 a.m.
She's the latest addition to our household, a big old long-haired cat we found wandering the neighborhood. She's become a companion for the dog in his old age, holding him down with one paw to lick his face clean. The problem is, she also tries to groom me at 3 a.m. What to do when your cat won't sleep? In desperation, we called Dr. Nicholas Dodman, director of the Animal Behavior Clinic at Cummings School of Veterinary Medicine at Tufts University here in Massachusetts. After ruling out medical problems, he got straight to the point.
What you have to realize is that cats are not, a lot of people think they're nocturnal. So they're always up at night and they sleep all day long, and that's incorrect. They're actually what's called crepuscular, which means they're dawn and then dusk creatures. So the dawn's the part that's worrying me a lot about your cat. That is, even before the sun has crept over the horizon, cat's beginning to stretch and get ready to get going. So your cat's motor seems to start running very early in the morning. Mm. One thing you can do is to try and screen out all kinds of outside influences, like, you know, double glazing to make sure that, you know, even the traffic and people moving around the streets is not something that's transmitted to the cat, like life is going on outside. And especially, you know, really thick curtains so the cat can't see any daylight coming through. If the room is silent and pitch black and you're just there sleeping quietly, there's no real reason for the cat to wake up.
Okay.
But then the other part of the equation is, if it does wake up, what happens next? And a lot of people respond to their cat waking up in the night and vocalizing or purring or whatever by petting it, or even worse, getting out of bed and feeding it something because they think it's hungry. And what you're doing now is you're reinforcing whatever behavior has just preceded as an attention-seeking behavior.
So are you saying that one step is to just ignore the cat for as long as you can?
Absolutely. What you have to do is you have to steel yourself to sticking to your own routine. You've got to have the cat entrain to your routine, not to allow you to get entrained into its crepuscular habits.
Okay.
Now, that can be tricky because when you ignore an attention-seeking behavior, first of all, what happens is it gets worse. Mm. And in order for you to tough that, might I suggest earplugs.
But if that doesn't work and you just really can't bear the lack of sleep, is there anything you can give a cat that would be natural and not harmful to the cat?
You need to do the behavior modification for sure. But to assist you on your course, you could give the cat melatonin. That would have to be given, you know, under veterinary direction. Mm-hmm. While you can buy it over the counter, who knows what the dose is. And the fact is, it depends on the cat.
Melatonin is a supplement that humans take as well. It sort of rejiggers your clock, your inner clock.
It's the sleep hormone. It's made by the pineal gland, and it's the thing that's responsible for our sort of diurnal rhythm of going to sleep and waking up. Another thing you can do, which is not drug-wise but natural, is to make sure you feed the cat a jolly great big meal last thing at night so that all the blood kind of rushes to its stomach, and, you know, especially if you were to feed certain foods like, you know, we know turkey-based foods contain tryptophan, or, you know, even a small bit of milk. You've got to watch out the cat doesn't have a lactose intolerance, but it's really the timing of the feeding which can also help to make the cat more soporific.
So, Dr. Dodman, it sounds like the tips are feed the cat later, both in the night and in the morning. Try behavior modification, just, you know, ignoring a cat as much as you can, and hopefully they'll stop. Mm-hmm. Or consult your veterinarian about trying melatonin, a supplement that might readjust their inner clock and get them to sleep during the night.
One Parthian shot is that you know, no doubt you're at work all day long, so your cat is sleeping all day long.
I'm assuming.
And when you come back, you know, the night time's the only time when there's anything going on in the apartment. So it's a good idea if you can possibly think of creative ways to keep your cat more active during the day. And certainly, most people don't understand, make sure your cat has tons of aerobic activity, panting, running around, chasing things, toys on strings, so that it has a good workout during the day and is therefore tired at night.
A tired cat is a good cat.
It's
like a kid.
It's exactly like a kid.
Dr. Dodman, thank you so much.
Okay, Robin.
Dr. Nicholas Dodman of Tufts University is also author of a number of books, including If Only They Could Speak and The Cat Who Cried for Help. Wait a minute. Maybe she's crying for help.
Yes, I love you too, but it's 3 o'clock in the morning.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. It's of Bamako with Amadou and Mariam. That's Taxi Bamako from Mali's husband and wife team, Amadou and Mariam. They're riding on the success of a new CD, just one of a fresh crop of African music we'll be listening to today. Milo Miles is World and Roots music critic for Public Radio, Rolling Stone, and the New York Times, and he's going to be our guide. Milo, welcome and thank you.
Thank you.
And the music that you've picked out today sounds very different from the synthesizer-driven dance music that we were hearing out of Africa, you know, in the 80s primarily. Are African artists wrestling with hanging on to more of their own identity?
Well, I think so. The question is, how do African popular performers sound both modern and yet not just copying Western trends? It's always going to be popular to do Western trends. Audiences like them. The West has defined modernism, but floating above all of African pop is the specter of colonialism, of being culturally co-opted by richer and more populous and powerful countries and cultural influences. For a long time, there would be performers such as Papa Wemba that would release a kind of slickly produced album for the Western market and then a more down-home and traditional album for the market back in his own country. And Youssou N'Dour is somebody that I would bring up that's actually been through all phases of this. When he was discovered by Peter Gabriel, he seemed to be going on a very sort of standard fusioning, crossover kind of route. But it certainly didn't sound particularly African. And since then, he's kind of gone off in the other direction. He's very established. And then he kind of felt that that phase was over and began to kind of go back to Senegal. And he became more involved in the community. And in 2004, he came out with an album called Egypt that evoked Islamic and Muslim roots of some of the Senegalese music, particularly the gigantic Egyptian star Oum Kulthoum of the 40s and 50s.
But you've brought us something from another Senegalese musician, Chion Sek, who had been overshadowed by Youssou N'Dour. I want to listen a little bit first to a duet he does with Indian vocalist Bombay Jayashree. Let's listen. I feel like I'm hearing more of the Indian and North African influence here.
Yes. He recorded with Egyptian musicians and went further and thought that this sounds to him somewhat like the Bollywood film soundtrack singers. And this was all done in studios in Paris and created this fusion that actually works, in my opinion, just about as well as Egypt. But it is exactly the same sort of thing, and it shows one way to form a kind of modernism that is transcultural. And it's neo-traditionalist without sounding anything like a Western record. This isn't following any Western trend.
That's Milo Miles speaking, a world music critic, and he's sharing some of the newest music to come out of Africa and some of the sounds that are actually going back to sound more African. We heard there from Chion Sek singing with Bombay Jayashree. I want to listen again to Amadou and Mariam. We began with their music. They're known in Africa as the blind couple. They are blind?
Yes, they met in a school for the blind and have been performing together for more than 20 years.
Enormously popular in Europe. They've been picked up by a French producer who wants to make them the next Buena Vista Social Club, meaning, you know, perhaps the one world music CD that everybody has, but also wants to give them a more contemporary sound. And to do that, singer Mariam Doumbia and her husband, guitarist Amadou Bakayoko, teamed up with Manu Chao, a big seller here in the U.S. Let's listen.
Où est la frontière entre les murs, se faufiler dans l'ascenseur, ascenseur pour le ghetto, au Manhattan, fast food, Dakar, Sénégal, cinéma de Paris.
Milo, what are we listening to, and what are you listening for?
Well, what I hear that was going on in this record that's very interesting to me is that Manu Chao, he's kind of an original neo-traditionalist before his time, that he was picking up on ska and funk and all sorts of international styles. And so now he's very interested in international culture and anti-globalization measures and avoiding hegemony by corporations and things like that. Amadou and Mariam are very much kind of idealists that have a consistent theme of universal brotherhood, harmony among peoples, and cultures that run through it. So when they met each other, they recognized they may be able to work together because there's a kind of fit between their ideas. And what Manu Chao gave them is a somewhat harder-edged, more kind of lively and big sound. One thing he does is he constantly mixes in crowd noises and traffic noises and radio announcements and media going on so that their Dimash Bamako sounds more like the kind of world community or the world meeting square that Amadou and Mariam kind of wanted to evoke. And it's something that makes them sound less folkloric and more internationalist.
Is that sort of the world take on hip-hop sampling?
Somewhat, yes. I mean, there's no question that hip-hop is very big in France, and Manu Chao pays attention to a lot of that, but it works out very well. It's a very, very well-done fusion record.
Amadou and Mariam, and by the way, we'll have a list of all the CDs that Milo is speaking about on our website, here-now.org, and that will include another singer from Senegal. This is Dabi Balde from the Casamance region in the south of Senegal, and perhaps that's why he sounds so different from Sek, who we heard.
Right. He fits into this neo-traditionalist because this is a kind of another way to preserve identity. The Fula language that he sings in is not well exposed. It has a richness and a depth, so it doesn't sound like some sort of preservationist folkloric record. It has a modern production on it, and yet, with his beautiful voice kind of floating over everything, you know you haven't heard this before, and so this is another way that he can be himself, bring his own culture from the south of Senegal into a modern-sounding record and not be modern by copying any Western trend and instead sound just like his own people and his own culture, which has not been exposed before, and this is something that people are getting better and better at doing.
This is Sora from Dabi Balde.
Abe da ban na kalole dum fa
Mano, si so ko sura
Wena me kumala sura numbun na
Mano, si so ko sura
Ala ning sura kora be kumala nma
Mano, si so ko sura
Ala ning sura bato be kumala nma
Mano, si so ko sura
It's so appealing.
Very warm and nice.
Yeah, and sounds as if he is finding his way between the traditional and the more trendy.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it's a very cleverly, you know, put in both camps. It has roots and branches, this record. It's a very appealing record.
Well, there you have it. Just a taste of some of the new music coming out of Africa, thanks to our guide, Milo Miles, a world and roots music critic. You may have heard his work on NPR's Fresh Air or read it in The Village Voice, Rolling Stone, The New York Times. And you can go to our website, actually, to read more. He's got some thoughts there at here-now.org. And Milo, thanks so much for visiting Here and Now.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories.